Great. Excellent. Thanks, everyone. This is How Does the Pandemic Challenge Privacy Smart Companies? And to start with, this session is being recorded, so we can send it out later and you can share with your colleagues that were unable to attend today. First and foremost, we want to make sure that everyone is certainly safe and healthy that's joining us today. And we know that lives are being disrupted right now, and we really appreciate everyone's time. Today, we are here to talk about some privacy challenges within the current environment we're in. And a quick round of introductions. Richard Purcell is a panelist with us today, and he is a pioneer in the information privacy space. He was actually the first chief privacy officer at Microsoft and was key in building the key pillar in the Trustworthy Computing Initiative at Microsoft. He was also the chairman of the Data Privacy and Integrity Committee with the Department of Homeland Security, and also a member of the FTC's Online Access and Security Advisory Committee. Also with us today is Camilla Tabon. Camilla is of counsel at Davis Graham and Stubbs, and her emphasis practicing law is on privacy and data security. She's a certified fellow of information privacy through IAPP, and also has CIPP credentials in both European and U.S. laws. And finally, and probably least important, is myself. I'm Joe Grant Blueshell, and I'm the founder of Boundary. Boundary is a new company formed that's focusing on information privacy, and probably more importantly, the promotion of ethical innovation. This is taking 20-plus years of former technology executive roles I've had in big data and analytics. So with all that said, today's themes, we wanted to provide some expert guidance in current conditions and really focus in on some important areas that organizations and individuals need to be thinking about. And finally, provide some experiences and lessons learned through all of this. Let's go ahead and jump right into this, and we'll see how it goes. So first off, first question for the two of you. Knowing that track and trace is incredibly important in the management of COVID-19, both in the short term and the long term reopening of businesses across the country, how do we balance this need for data and analytics from a track and trace perspective with privacy? So for this first question, I'll start with you, Camilla.
Thanks, Joe. So I think definitely technology and information are going to play a key role in responding to the pandemic. But I think the main questions are, what technology should we use? What information should we collect? And how should we use it? The two that I've heard most talked about are location tracking, which is based on where you are, and then contact tracing or proximity tracking, which is based on who you've been in contact with. So I use a really basic example. So pretend we have a beauty salon and someone in the beauty salon gets infected with the disease. So location tracking would mean that everybody that we know visited the store based on their mobile device being in that location, we would notify them and tell them, you may have come into contact with someone who was infected. That might produce a lot of false positives, right? A lot of people would have gone to the salon when the infected person wasn't working, and so it could raise alarms that would be unnecessary. The other way would be if we knew what mobile devices came into contact with the mobile device of that infected person, we could then identify those specific individuals and alert them that they may have been in contact with someone who was infected. So those are the two types of tracking technologies that are being talked about. Another one that's interesting is the connected devices, right? So there's connected devices collect a lot of information, and there's a connected thermometer company that has information, on temperature readings from folks who are using the thermometer, and they've been able to identify hotspots based on the temperature readings of individuals in particular geographical locations to suggest that, you know, community spread is occurring and people are becoming infected. So there are a lot of different ways that information could be harnessed. There are a lot of different types of information that could be used and collected. And I think from a privacy perspective, the things that we should be thinking about are things that we would normally think about when we're collecting and using sensitive information, right? So think about like privacy by design. What does that mean? That means if you're going to be collecting information about individuals, you should think early on in the design phase how to build in privacy protections. How are you going to, for example, make privacy settings, default settings in your product or application? Think about using privacy-enhancing technologies. So things like differential privacy, which inserts noise into aggregate data in order for you not to be able to specifically identify an individual from that data. Things like that might be of use. And then things that we would normally do, right? Like risk assessments. How is the collection of this data going to impact individuals? How are we going to secure this information? How are we going to ensure that it's only used for limited purposes? How long are we going to keep this information? Those types of things. And then, you know, have a defined purpose and be transparent about that purpose, right? If we're going to be asking people to give over certain information that they wouldn't normally be giving over, they need to understand why we need it, what it is that we're specifically going to be collecting. And then we need to think about, okay, when this whole when the whole purpose for using and needing this data is over, are we going to stop these practices? So I think the traditional privacy tools that we have at our disposal for developing any sort of product or application that might affect individuals would work in this scenario. I think the tricky thing is because it's the way the pandemic has unfolded, there's sort of urgency, maybe sometimes even panic. And so there's not the time to think about these things maybe as thoughtfully as we would like, but they're nevertheless very important to ensuring that folks' privacy is respected.
Yeah, absolutely. Richard, anything to add on that one?
Yeah, I wanted to reinforce the transparency comments that Camilla has made. One of the things that track and trace need as support, because it just doesn't matter if you track and trace if you don't have testing. There's a big national dialogue going on about testing right now. And the importance of having the ability to test people. If you track and trace, you have to test then too. In order to make sure that you eliminate false positives, that you identify the actual positive cases, and then you do isolate quarantines and those kinds of things. Those incredibly important to test, and that's key. The other part of transparency is providing notice. When people are being tracked, traced, notified, et cetera, the kind of disclosures that are necessary are pretty profound. And it may be a little overwhelming for people to understand exactly how complicated and how widespread some of the data sharing will be, the collection and data sharing and the transfer. So part of that transparency requires oversight. There have to be people who are being carefully monitoring how this is working in real time, not just 4 or 5 months later as a post facto. What we need is we really need oversight on a real time basis and accountability so that everybody who is playing this game, who is actually trying to be part of the solution, doesn't become part of the problem by either avoiding or deflecting their accountability. So my overall comment for all of this is involve a privacy professional now. Most of these companies don't have a privacy professional on board. I agree that transparency, that privacy by design, that accountability, that oversight, all of these things we're talking about are procedures that are part and parcel of what very large corporations with good trained staff who are IAPP certified, who are, you know, professionals, they have these. A lot of the companies we're talking about don't have any of that. Get privacy professionals involved early. Privacy by design requires early intervention by people who know what they're talking about here. So people like Camilla, like myself, like you, Joe, have to get involved early and have authority to actually take action.
Yeah, great points. So Richard, a follow-up for you on a slightly different note here. As organizations are dealing with this from a business operations and continuity perspective, what safeguards should organizations be rolling out to support remote workforces?
Yeah. Again, large corporations have IT staffs, big network and systems controls, database administrators. All of these people are trained as overseers of network security. As we go into remote work conditions, a lot of that falls apart. Now, there are still, as long as you have good VPN, there are bad VPN solutions. As long as you have good VPN solutions that are well monitored by a big staff, all of those kinds of things, some of those concerns are allayed. However, when you work at home, are you really prepared for the potential for breach and breach management? My position is it's absolutely inevitable that we will have data breaches as a result of all of the remote access that we're providing to people right now. It's a given. It's not a question of if something like this is going to happen. The breaches will be happening. Are people preparing now to identify and minimize those breach conditions, to manage them and mitigate any damage that results? Are there chain of care standards being put in place so that when people have remote access and they mishandle data in some way, that the information is captured? Who's affected, what's affected, how's it affected, how to stop it, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of the questions I have have to do with confidentiality of data in a off-network environment. So are people at home printing out documents that have confidential information? Are they actually handling that in the same way they would inside their office building with confidential information disposal, shredding, et cetera, et cetera? Are they moving documents into personal devices or removable devices that now have to be controlled in a specific way? These are questions. The answers to all of this are complicated and pretty much conditional and contextual to the business itself. I'm trying to address the things people should be thinking about right now.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Camilla, any follow-up on that one?
Well, I think the situation highlights the importance of being proactive. So there are policies that companies could have in place that would address some of these issues that are arising. For example, business continuity plans, information security policies, remote work policies, the bring your own device policy. So the issues that a remote workforce presents, right, are several. There's, you know, new access points, right? So people from home accessing company systems, how are you going to control that access? Richard mentioned VPN. There's also remote desktops, for example. So how are folks going to be able to log into company systems and access their company email, company information, all that kind of stuff? We're all home, so I guess that's in one sense helping us out in that, like, the proximity issues are really based on our home life and, you know, who we're working around. We're not like in coffee shops where you don't know if the Wi-Fi is secure, you don't know who could be eavesdropping over your shoulder or whatever. So I guess that's a little bit more controlled. But I think the main issues are for organizations, they have to think about these new potential access points, the new normal where everybody is working in close proximity to others from other organizations. And then the other piece is, of course, now that we're using new tools, and they're not new tools in the sense that they didn't exist before, right? Like video conferencing tools and all that kind of stuff. But for some users, they are new. It raises the issue of how companies conduct their security risk assessments, right? So the whole vendor management process. When you're going to onboard a vendor, you're going to do due diligence on their security practices, and then you're going to enter into a contract with them that's going to tie them to certain security practices with regard to the information of yours that they're receiving and processing. And so the importance of having done that security analysis up front, right? Now when everybody's using these video conferencing measures, each company will have done their own analysis and will have identified potential gaps. One thing that I've been seeing is companies looking to fast track that due diligence process. So it wasn't a vendor that they had engaged before, but now they need it in order for their remote workforce to function effectively. And so how do you fast track those things? Because sometimes these vendor assessment questionnaires are 100 questions and they take a lot of time. And so I think that's an issue that's been propping up. I will say that it's important to do it right. And if you identify gaps, it's important to work with the vendor to remediate those gaps just to try to preempt any issues that may arise. And then the breach point is a really good point. Many companies have incident response plans. Some of those test those plans with tabletop exercises, right? So they go through a mock breach scenario and test the plan and see how it actually works. I think even though we're working remotely, if you haven't done that already, I think it's very valuable to do because, as Richard said, it's not a question of if, but when. We have been seeing a rise in cyber attacks. We have been seeing a rise in business email compromise. And so the security piece is a very important piece. And I think for organizations in this situation, there's just more moving parts than they were used to having before. And so I think communication is key.
So, Camilla, as a follow-up on that, we're all working from home, as you guys mentioned previously. So how should employers and employees handle the commingling of personal lives and work lives when everyone's working remotely?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's guidance. There's guidance from the FTC. The FTC is the Federal Trade Commission. For employees working from home, the things that they should be thinking about. So is their workspace secure? Is the Wi-Fi secure? Are your devices secure? Are you locking your screen when you're walking away? Things like that. In addition, we mentioned video conferencing. There were a lot of issues related to a particular video conferencing platform, and they now updated their security page that has some helpful hints for users of that platform, how they can secure their conference calls. But essentially, I think it's the same types of things that you would do in the office, you should be sure that you're doing at home. Richard mentioned a really important point about physical documents. If you have sensitive information, you have to secure it appropriately, even though you're at home. You have to dispose of it appropriately, even though you're at home. I think it's going to be harder to keep work and personal life separate, but I think for individuals, think about, like, if you're using your work device, don't do personal stuff on it, and vice versa. It's going to be harder to keep that separation, but I think that's going to be important for organizations to protect and secure their data. And one thing I think that is helpful is just continuous communication, right? So if the FBI has information that they put out on sort of scams that they've been seeing, for example, phishing attempts related to COVID-19, circulate those to your workforce so that they're aware of these potential, threats and can manage that risk appropriately.
Yeah, great points. Richard?
Well, I think those are all the kinds of points I would make as well. I think emphasis, more than anything else, would be It's probably increasingly important that people separate their work and their personal devices. It's really easy to cross over those two things right now while you're on different calls or you're at in a home environment. Now, additionally, we're not in coffee shops, as Camilla says, but we also don't have a lot of visitors in our houses, right? But there will be. And so a lot of people may have put together a temporary workspace. They didn't have a work at home space that was dedicated. And once the confinement to home is lifted, those orders are lifted or eased, and people are starting to occupy other spaces, there should be a general spring cleaning of any work-related activity in the home to make sure that the confidential information is secured, is properly destroyed if necessary, those kinds of things. So there's a post-COVID kind of condition that I think that we need to think through with your workspace. We talk in the office about having a clean desk. It applies in the work environment, whether it's at home or whether it's a remote access point. The other thing I think that is one of the things I would really like to stress for companies is if you have a data classification schema where you mark documents, it is time to enforce it. If you don't enforce it, it is time to revisit that. If you don't have a data classification schema and your company is fairly lax at marking documents, this is a very good time to think that through a little more carefully, because in a remote access environment, the documents themselves are going to have to tell the story of how to be handled, how to be secured, how to be with whom to share, how to be transferred, et cetera, et cetera. So companies that revisit and the policies and processes around data classification and marking are going to be advantaged by helping secure their remote workforce a little better.
Yeah, the color commentary for me on this one, I find it interesting. I've been working remote most of my career, travel a lot and visit a lot of remote offices and work in a wide variety of places. I think the number one rule of thumb is to create some boundaries between your work environment and your home environment. And that's both from a schedule perspective, but also from a physical controls perspective as well. And it just makes things so much cleaner. All right. So moving on, Richard, we'll start with you on this one. So are there any workplace privacy issues, especially with companies that have essential work going on right now regarding community health concerns?
There's a lot. I think we're full of that right now. As an overall comment, one thing I want to mention is that there was a recent survey by a law firm, and it indicates that the legal counsel in companies are heavily distracted away from privacy and security concerns and toward the top three concerns, which include labor law and employee compensation issues, huge issues around that, compliance with all of this alphabet soup of federal programs going on, the Paycheck Protection, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program. They're trying to navigate the very difficult rules and kind of fragmented rule structures of that. They're also looking at supplier and vendor contract situations and issues, payments that are owed to companies, payments that companies owe their suppliers. Those are being very distracting right now. And of course, inventory management, supply chain management are two very big issues. What that means is general counsels are not looking at privacy and security very closely right now. They just don't have the bandwidth to do it because of these pressing concerns. These immediate priorities are important because they take care of people first, and that's good. But employees have really long memories, and they're going to remember how you handled the situation. And it will affect loyalty. It will affect the morale of the workforce going forward as you proceed through this. And the same survey indicated that general counsels don't believe this is going to turn off anytime soon. In fact, it may be up to 2 years before these effects are even cut in half. So we have a very long period now of vulnerability, because of COVID-19, but even as we reduce our vulnerability to the disease, to the virus, we are going to continue to be vulnerable from a privacy and security standpoint because of our reactions. So we have to really think through this and, again, engage the professionals. Do people really know about the HHS waiver for business associates and others and data transfers under HIPAA? There's some pretty confusing but profoundly important kinds of issues around that when your workforce has viral infections, when you want to protect public and community health. The reporting mechanisms, because it's a health issue, have regulatory standards, but those standards have now changed somewhat. So are you familiar with how they've changed? I think, Camilla, you should take the lead on a lot of how these laws are being interpreted or enforced in a differential manner during this period.
Absolutely. So what's interesting is when you're talking about employee privacy and employee monitoring, you're faced with a patchwork of rules and regulations, right? So we don't have a single comprehensive privacy law in the US like you would see in Europe with the GDPR. Instead, we have, federal regulations, we have state laws, we have sometimes local requirements. And on the employee piece, I think the main players, so to speak, would be the Americans with Disabilities Act. It would be anti-discrimination laws. It would be the Rehabilitation Act, things like that. And the best guidance on these issues is from the United States Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. They have a website devoted to coronavirus guidance, and they actually have a webinar where they've answered a series of questions on what you can and can't do in terms of employee monitoring and what you can and can't do in terms of disclosing information about employees who are sick with COVID-19. So what's interesting is the EEOC thought about these issues a long time ago when faced with the H1N1 pandemic, and they came out with guidance that they've since updated. What's interesting is one of the key exceptions that the EEOC uses or views in order to determine whether employees can be subject to medical examinations, whether you can ask about symptoms and diagnoses, things like that, is whether the disease poses a direct threat. And at the time of H1N1, that the finding was that no, it does not pose a direct threat. Well, that's different now with the novel coronavirus and COVID-19. Because of its high infectiousness, it is being viewed as a direct threat because it poses a substantial risk of harm, both to the employee, but also to those around them. So for example, can you, ask an employee who calls in sick about symptoms that they're experiencing? And the answer from the EEOC is yes, because this is a direct threat. You can ask, and they specify the symptoms that we're all familiar with, COVID-19, fever, a dry cough, things like that. But then the question is, so what can you do with that information? So if you ask the employee and they tell you, yes, they have symptoms, you still have to maintain that information confidential, right? Because it's employee health information. But you do have the ability to notify certain individuals in upper management that might need to know. And you can tell employees that might have been exposed that they are at risk, but you can't disclose the name of the employee, right? So you can't say so-and-so is sick. You can say instead, we believe that you came into contact with someone who has been diagnosed with COVID-19. So that's sort of the basics. There's a lot of nuances. For example, you know, one of the at-risk populations are individuals over, it's either age 60 or 65. There's nuances around how you can address those at-risk populations without triggering the anti-discrimination laws and things like that. So it's important to check with employment counsel, but from a privacy perspective, I think what's interesting is that there are protections in place for employees and employee data, and employers are required to use good judgment when determining, you know, what policies to put in place, whether they're going to check temperatures for everybody who's coming into the work site, for example, and things like that. I think it's important to think those through. I think if you're going to do something, you should probably have a policy. You should probably check it with both privacy and employment counsel, and then you should move forward sort of on a standardized basis.
Yeah, along those lines regarding regulations and laws, and this is very open-ended, and I know it's a speculative question. I'm curious on both of your takes, though. Do you believe legislation like GDPR, CCPA, or HIPAA may need to be re-examined or even parts of it readdressed based on what we're learning in the current environment? So, well, Camilla, as a follow-up.
I'll start. Camilla is the legal representative here, so I'll give my non-lawyer answer to that, which is hell yes. The laws around data protection and privacy in the United States are woefully inadequate to the challenges that we're facing. And the novel coronavirus has exposed so many different vulnerabilities in our legal system and our social systems that need to be addressed. So federal law, a comprehensive, useful federal law is needed, without a doubt. There's been a lot of push. In my 25 years in privacy, we've seen about five different significant eras during which federal privacy law was considered, but then set aside because some other crisis or catastrophe happened, whether it was the dot-com bust or the 9/11 attacks or the recession of 2008 or, you know, now COVID-19. There's always been something that rose to a level where it became less important, less a priority to pass a federal law. This is another one that we're seeing because there's been a lot of momentum toward a federal law over the last year. And, you know, I'm desperately hoping that momentum will continue post-COVID period. So, yes, we need this very, 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 very much. And I'm sure, Camilla, you have strong views on this as well.
I do. I mean, I think this definitely highlights the importance of having a federal privacy law. I mean, the way that we approach privacy in the U.S. is either based on the type of information that you're using or the activity that you're engaging in. And there are certain sectors of our business community that is largely unregulated, or it's difficult to regulate them, even though they're amassing massive amounts of data just because of the way that this patchwork has been set up, right? They're not necessarily collecting protected health information, even though they may be collecting biometric or medical information from wearable devices, for example. So I think that this highlights the importance of a federal privacy law. I think there's two difficult things with that. I think one is, are we going to have a principles-based law, or are we going to take the approach if we're going to tell people what they can and can't do with information, right? So, like, if you look at HIPAA, if you look at the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, they talk about permitted uses of data, permitted disclosures, and then prohibited uses, prohibited disclosures with exceptions and things like that. the CCPA tries to be a little bit more principles-based, right? So broad definition of personal information, putting requirements on businesses that collect and handle that information to be transparent with users, to provide them specific rights, things like that. I think that's something that's going to have to be balanced in order for any federal privacy law to be effective. The other thing, and I think this is just particular to our legal system, one of the big hiccups, I think, for federal privacy law will be private right of action. So private right of action would basically allow individuals to sue to enforce the law. And when the California Consumer Privacy Act was first, you know, in its early stages, it had a very broad private right of action. That has since now been narrowed to a private right of action for breaches for failure to implement reasonable security measures. So the question is, will a federal law take that same approach? Will it try to have a broader private right of action? And so I think that, you know, that's going to be a key issue. If we look at Washington, Washington was pretty close to passing a privacy law this year, and it ended up not making it, it ended up not being passed before the legislative session closed because the House added a provision that would allow individuals to enforce the law under the state consumer protection statute. And so that essentially included a private right of action for any violation of the law, and that was pretty much the death knell for that bill. So while I think that this issue, that the, you know, the pandemic has highlighted the significance and the need for a federal privacy law, I still think that there are some significant barriers to that. That being said, I think if we think about, for example, location tracking and the information that, you know, telecoms providers have about individuals and their locations based on where they are with their mobile devices, that type of thing, this highlights the dichotomy that we have, that if you live in California, you have the right to ask the company what information they have about you, what they've collected, who they've shared it with, but folks who reside in other parts of the country don't have that right. So there are inequalities that we're seeing, and I think depending on how, you know, public authorities leverage information in order to address the pandemic and start processing new data or start processing existing data in new ways, we're going to see that rights that, for example, residents in California have are more protective than individuals who don't live there and pretty much have very little control over what information about them is being collected and how it's being used and disclosed. So I think this is definitely highlights the need for more regulation in this space. I'm just cautiously optimistic about it.
Joe, I have another comment on that, one last comment on, mm-hmm. on federal privacy law. It requires an enforcement mechanism and an enforcement bureau mm-hmm. or agency that is clearly in charge. Today's rules are not only fragmented across these different industries and different activities and across these different jurisdictions, they're also fragmented in terms of enforcement. You know, HHS enforces HIPAA, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley is enforced in a certain way, the general privacy kind of statutes like COPPA are enforced by the Federal Trade Commission. There isn't a single enforcement mechanism or agency. And so definitions are different. Language is different. It is, if you looked at a fragment, you know what a fractal is. Well, this is, you know, fractalized. It's not just fragmented. It's not just in pieces. It's in, the pieces are in pieces themselves too. There is no reasonable or rational explanation for why data protection and privacy laws in the United States exist the way they do, except that powerful interests have created that. We've got to cut through that and make sure that there is a more singularly impressive interpreter, adjudicator and enforcer to this, much like the information commissioners in Canada and the European Union have set themselves out. And they have to have real authority.
Yeah, and if I can just add one thing, I mean, I think these are issues that definitely are being considered. I wanted to mention the U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. They held a paper hearing last week on the use of big data for fighting the pandemic. And so they took written testimony submissions from various stakeholders. And it's interesting, nearly all of them said, you know, this just demonstrates the need for a federal privacy law. And on Richard's point about enforcement, I mean, I think the natural enforcer for these types of issues would be the Federal Trade Commission. They right now have enforcement authority under Section 5 of the FTC Act, which allows them to enforce against deceptive and unfair trade practices. That's gone far, I think, I mean, to protect consumer rights. But I think that for any federal privacy law to have teeth, as Richard says, the enforcing authority is also going to have the ability to, you know, conduct investigations and issue fines and enforce the law. And I think that's also going to be one of the key points that are going to be discussed when determining how and when to put a federal privacy law in effect.
Yeah, I agree with you guys. It's just a little personal story about me. Richard knows this. I've been studying for the CIPP, and number one, it's disrupted. I can't even take the exam right now because all the testing centers are shut down. But studying for that exam over the last several months, fractal and sectoral models really does make it rather confusing, especially for someone like me coming from tech. Not necessarily the legal aspect. So I think of your average consumer, and you talked about the private right to action. I don't even know if most consumers are even going to understand what that is or where to turn to if they have a problem. So it's going to be a real big challenge moving forward. Last question around some of these same topics here from a legal perspective is, you know, we talked a bit today about location tracking and biometric data. You've both seen it in the news that there's discussion about a potential national surveillance program and some large big data platform where a lot of this data is shared and ingested. From a civil liberties perspective and a constitutional right perspective, what kind of concerns need to be addressed for some of these national surveillance type of initiatives? So maybe Richard, we'll start with you and move to Camilla.
Well, I think that after the 9/11 attacks, there were a lot of lessons learned. One of those lessons is it useful to surveil an entire population in order to look for specific conditions? Or is it more useful to look at specific activities, much like an investigator would do, and then follow that? So track and trace is an example of how you would surveil an entire community and then follow that community's actions. And as a result, it's very easy to bring in, because it's so broad-based, it's very easy to bring in behaviors, activities, anomalies that you're not looking for, but you do come across as a result. We did that in post 9/11. Camilla talked about the temperature tracking application, which is fascinating and really worth looking at, because what it does is it takes this broad base, but it only looks at the anomalies. It doesn't look at the whole broad base. And so therefore, it is less likely, not unlikely, but less likely to bring in unintended activities into its scope. So the question really is, do we do mass surveillance of everybody in order to look for the cases that we're trying to identify? Or do we look for investigative clues and then follow those down in a much narrower context? My preference is certainly toward the latter, because frankly, scope creep just gets immediately involved as soon as you have the more generalized surveillance activities going on, which could be used for all kinds of different purposes outside of the intended purpose. So the question, and frankly, Okay, let's have mass surveillance. Great. But let's disclose and let's be transparent. There's no way you can be transparent about mass surveillance. It is an impossible condition to enforce. People don't even understand what online advertising technology, how it works, and you can't disclose it, much less what a mass surveillance program would be, which would, I mean, sure, we'd use cell phone records, and we'd use Bluetooth from the cell phones, and we'd use tower records, but then, you know, we'd also use street cameras too, traffic cameras to and license plate readers would probably be part of, and facial recognition would probably be part of that too, and oh my God. Now, there, if you look at some of the best managed COVID-19 programs, they used mass surveillance and they controlled the spread of the virus very effectively. Okay. Do we have that national conversation? The time to have a national conversation isn't in the midst of a crisis. It is to be a well-considered conversation when people are not panicking and people are not trying to make up solutions on the fly. It's very, very difficult to answer the question, but technology doesn't have moral standards. Moral standards are programmed into technology by human beings. We face this with AI, we face this with automated transportation, we face the moral standards that programmers and coders have to be aware of and utilize as they develop technology, because technology doesn't have those standards built in. That's a conversation we have yet to have in an effective way, and we must have, but this is not the moment that we can have it.
Yeah, I think scope creep is probably the biggest concern. One of the things that I was reading that was an interesting take on this is, you know, companies have a lot of information about us. Sometimes we know they have this information, sometimes we don't know, sometimes we're not sure, but they already have this information and they're already using it for their own purposes. I mean, it could be for serving particular ads, depending on where you are. It could be for finding if there are people in close proximity to you that have similar interests, whatever it is. And so if we want to use that information for new ways, right, for public surveillance, for purposes of addressing the novel coronavirus, you know, are we going to be able to put privacy protections around that such that, you know, the engineers who are already using this information are going to be, you know, not able to use it for certain things or not be able to be as flexible with it as they want to be? So maybe the better way is to collect new information, right? So I'm thinking about the contact tracing where it's relies on Bluetooth and which travels short distances. And so my mobile device would send, you know, randomly generated Bluetooth signals that would be tracked on phones of people who came in close proximity with me. And if I got infected, there would be sort of a matching, and anybody who received a ping from my phone would be alerted, not that I was infected, but that they came into proximity with someone who was infected. And so that's a new collection, right? And the privacy protections would be, well, we're using randomized IDs. There's the information is going to reside on the phone itself. And so no one's going to have specific access to it unless there's a need to do this matching exercise. And so I think trying to figure out new ways to collect specific information in a limited context for a specifically defined use would be certainly more protective than using data that companies already have about us based just on their, you know, commercial practices. Accountability, I think, is really important. So, you know, who's going to be using these and how developing technologies and applications and how they're going to be doing it. There's in Europe, the European Data Protection Board, which is tasked with overseeing the GDPR, issued guidance about, you know, contact tracing apps. And one of the things that they said is the source code should be made available, right? People should be able to go in and test how you're doing it. Similar to the point that Richard made, you know, if you're using machine learning or algorithms to make certain determinations, there has to be a way to make sure that you're not introducing bias into that, you know, if you're making a determination about a particular person. So accountability is really important. And then lastly, transparency. I mean, I think if you asked us all, would you give up a little bit of privacy, you know, to help your neighbor, to help your family member, we'd all say yes, for sure. But do we really know what we're giving up, right? Are companies being transparent about what they're doing, what they're collecting, how they're using it, when they're going to get rid of the information, all that kind of stuff? So I think these are, big issues, but going back to my earlier theme, they're not new issues, right? These are things that we've been focusing on from a privacy perspective, you know, when we're focusing on personal information. It's just that now, you know, it's sort of magnified.
A point I'd like to make there, Camilla, well stated. If we think about Camilla's last statement in context of the need for a federal privacy law, very little of what she explained as being necessary is actually part of our legal structure. We talk as privacy professionals from a global point of view of a principled approach to privacy. The mass surveillance issue brings up all of these ideas of disclosure, transparency, of securing, of limited access, limited purpose, onward transfer protections, minimization of data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are not ensconced in U.S. privacy law. They don't exist exactly in that way. And so if we talk about mass surveillance without having a federal privacy law, I don't know exactly how we're discussing it. We're discussing a program that has, a nearly non-existent legal basis for being protected for protecting people. So there's a cart before the horse. And again, this is why I say this is not the time. In the midst of crisis is not the time to actually do this. That we need to be better prepared for the next crisis by actually instituting these legal frameworks within which then we could practice some kind of better community health protections.
Yeah, one thing I find it interesting, both of you brought up scope creep. Last night I was wondering, would my health insurance company be interested in knowing that I picked up a 12-pack of beer and went through Taco Bell's drive-in last night? So that those are things that I think all of us need to think about. We're running up against time here. So one last question, kind of open-ended for both of you. And this is really just to ask, are there any additional key takeaways around privacy, around protection, around security that orgs should be thinking about in particular after this pandemic is gone? So Richard, we'll start with you and we'll wrap up with Camilla.
Quickly, business resiliency is incredibly important at a time like this. We've taken this huge hit. I was listening to a local, I'm in the Seattle area, a local restaurateur just discussed yesterday how hard it was to shut down the restaurants, how expensive it was to shut down the restaurants, and then to bring them back up takes 2 or 3 full weeks before they can actually open up again. So the idea that you have a resilient business that can actually handle crisis situations and then restore services as quickly as possible is something that many businesses don't actually think through as carefully as perhaps they should. These disruptions are going to be and more likely, let's say, if not inevitable, whether it's from climate change, social change, technological change, biological problems, military actions, diplomatic disruptions, whatever the case be, climatological, hurricanes, whatever. Resilience planning is a very important part of all businesses. Now, to wrap up this whole thing, part of your resilience should be an information governance program that has all of these principles built into it, privacy by design, monitoring, accountability, oversight, all of that kind of thing are all important parts of it. That's a piece of resiliency. It's not the whole thing.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, we're in crisis mode, and so everything's moving much faster, but I think this highlights the need for being proactive and for planning, right? So what policies can you put in place that when, you know, everything runs amok, you can leverage those policies in order to ensure business continuity, in order to ensure that your people can work in different locations, things like that. So being proactive, I think, even though we might not see this exact same thing again, and we can't foresee what the next major event is going to be, but we can suspect that something will happen. If we take this and the learnings from the situation, we can apply them to internal policies, and we can be more prepared to react the next time.
You know, Joe, one of the things that in like decades of doing this, the one thing I always run into with businesses is, data protection and privacy, that's just a barrier, man. Show me what the revenue is. Where's the ROI on privacy? Well, I tell you what, the ROI on privacy is the same as it is on table talks exercises, on training, on policy development, on procedures, on training, on training, on training. The ROI is you actually get to recover when something bad goes on. And if you don't expect something bad to ever happen to your business, then you're just living in Pollyanna land. It's just not going to happen. So resilience, business continuity requires planning and training, and those things are not ROI until they are.
Great point. Well, Camilla and Richard, I really appreciate your time today. I think this is very insightful, and I look forward to number one, maybe doing some other video chats like this with the two of you down the road. And most importantly, I look forward to, you know, maybe sitting down and having lunch with you guys again someday and getting out of our basements.
Yeah, we'll see you in September for that.
Hopefully. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the call. And for those of you that are listening to this, if you have any follow-up, you can either reach out to DSG through the invitation that was sent to you, or you can contact Boundary at info@boundree.info. With that, thanks again, Richard and Camilla, and have a great day.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
You.